Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Gordon Stiles, a Chinese businessman, talks about the world economic system and why China is so different to here. Also, Michael Tyler has done a blog about the dead bankers over the last 10 years. Moin Yassin runs a Muslim think tank, and he'll be doing a conference in December about the Muslim version of the end of the world. Plus, Max Backman from Dresden has just been to Moscow with nearly 250 other Germans on a peace mission over 2 weeks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. I'll give you contact details at the end of the show. So we start this week with Gordon Stiles. He's a British businessman who had to stop his business up in the northeast because he couldn't be successful here in Britain in engineering, so he moved to China.
I've been there 11 years. I started as a one-man business in a bedroom in a hotel in Dongguan. Now we've got over 200 people. We've got a pretty big factory. We occupy about 60,000 square feet. I mean, I'm definitely, from an engineering and business point of view, absolutely rooted in China. That's for sure.
Well, it sounds to me like the brain drain. You know, you're doing some of the real high-end engineering here in Britain, and it sounds to me like you're never coming back.
Well, you know, we have to look to our leaders and our politicians to answer the question, why are so many good engineers leaving the country? And part of the reason is that engineering simply cannot attract the investment or the loans that are required to do the job properly. Without very significant investment in infrastructure and engineering and science and construction, this country's manufacturing and engineering sector is literally just withering on the vine.
Well, so, look, but the thing is, you know, with the money is one thing. You know, obviously, yeah, it's very difficult to fathom why the banks will lend to one person that seems to have a brilliant idea, maybe someone like yourselves, maybe not to lend to you. You know, that's almost an unfathomable question, even though in economics textbooks it's all supposed to be, well, if it's viable, the banks will lend. But that doesn't seem to work in practice. But what about what the government's doing in terms of support and infrastructure to help engineering in China that it's not doing here in Britain?
China is a very, very different economy to most other economies on Earth. And it's as follows. They have two key sectors. They have the state-owned enterprise sector and they have the private sector. 55% of all industrial output from China is actually in the state-owned enterprise sector and 45% in the privately owned sector. Now, the privately owned sector is not really supported at all. I don't think it's supported really much more than, say, Britain supports its private sector. But the state sector is heavily supported, just like South Korea used to with the Kaibols. You have exactly the same in China. Huge, huge companies with enormous loans.
So what were they, for those that haven't heard of them, the Kaibols, what are they?
Well, it was an expression about huge companies in Korea that built up only because the dictators in Korea at the time decided that state banks would lend huge amounts of money to them to create these huge companies, that's all. And that's exactly what they're doing in China. China, in fact, is almost following that model.
What about the economy? Because we keep hearing that China is on the brink. Well, I mean, sometimes people look at Britain and the Eurozone and the dollar and think that that's on the brink too. But a lot of the fingers have been pointing at China and saying, well, the Chinese have mismanaged their economy. We were used to having quite a big demand from China, and that demand has been slacking off.
I would wholly disagree with the statement that China is mismanaging their economy. They're actually managing it better than almost any other government on earth. Their growth is not as fast as it used to be. You know, they're growing in the region of the sort of 6-7% now. But if you step back 11 years to when I went there, when they were growing at 11%, 11% in monetary terms then is a lot less than 6% in monetary terms now. So they're actually growing more in value now than they were 11 years ago. It's just the percentage is declining. So to say that China is not growing or its growth is slowing, it's only slowing in percentage terms, not in actual output terms. In terms of how China actually manages its economy, it has a very, very strong central control, but it also allows regional governments to operate their provinces and also the individual cantons by themselves. They have very, very high local autonomy.
Right, so they're farming out a lot of the financial decision-making to the local governments, whereas Britain, it seems, they're doing a complete opposite. They're bringing a lot of the budget spending decisions into Westminster.
I don't know.
Well, they certainly are.
I thought they were devolving it out to sort of.
Well, they say they are. They certainly like to say they are. But anyway, what are your thoughts about the general health of the world economy? Because there's people on all different sides. Some saying that 2008 was a very long recession, but now we're starting to pick up. What's your experience?
Well, the world economy is growing moderately healthily. I looked at the figures the other day. I'm not sure exactly how it is. I think it's about 3% globally. You'd have to check that figure. But when you consider that's across 7 billion people, that's not actually that bad. But what it hides is that the Southeast Asian economies are doing extremely well, growing very, very strongly, as is India and a few other nations. What it's hiding is the malaise in Europe. Europe as a whole is in the doldrums, and it's in the doldrums because its banking sector is teetering on the edge of collapse and the banks are not prepared to continue to lend money. That's probably the biggest single problem Europe is facing today is a potential new banking crisis. And on that note, one only has to look at the share graph for Deutsche Bank to see that they're on the brink of collapse. And if Deutsche Bank goes down or has to be rescued, the contagion could spread all across Europe and could plunge us into a second pretty long recession, I think.
Yeah, but it sounds like a bit like a house of cards. But why? What's your analysis of why Europe is just kind of hit a brick wall when it comes to growth?
I actually read I read a book the other day by Yanis Yarafakis. I forget the exact title, but it's something like The Weak Shall Suffer What They Must, something like that. One of the best books I've ever read on Europe and why it is in the situation that it's in. I'd strongly recommend anyone to read it if they want to know why leaving the Eurozone and leaving EU is a very, very good idea. It comes down to one single problem, banks. It really is about banking. It's also to do with the fact that we do not have what's called a political surplus recycling system in the Eurozone. We're not in the Eurozone, but it still affects us. That means when one country like Germany makes a huge surplus against a country like Greece that makes a huge deficit, as the Greeks make this deficit, they need to get money back somehow. So they borrow it, and you borrow it from the surplus country like Germany. So what happened for the last sort of 15 years is that the Germans were lending loads and loads and loads of money to Greece, and the interest rates were very high, and no one really cared if it was dangerous because they figured that the governments would bail them out. After 2008 and 2010 in the United States and in Europe respectively, it was absolutely confirmed that the governments will bail out the banks. So now you're sitting in a situation where the banks have huge, huge liabilities in places like Greece and Italy and Portugal and Ireland and elsewhere. Frankly, if these were businesses, if these were normal businesses, particularly engineering businesses, they'd have all gone bust by now. They'd have all been put out of business. They'd all be in administration. But because governments simply cannot allow these behemoth banks like Deutsche Bank to crash, because they will literally take down economies with them, then they keep bailing them out. So it's this not having a surplus recycling system where you tax a surplus and literally give it to the deficit country, and the fact that governments are prepared to bail out these behemoth banks that has led to this malaise in Europe. And if you read Yanis Yarafakis, you'll read that he says there is no way out of this.
Well, some people call these behemoth banks, sometimes some people call them zombie banks, don't they? Do you think that's appropriate?
Absolutely appropriate. They're all dead. They just don't know it yet.
What's any thoughts about what we should be doing? If you were in the Chancellor's shoes here in Britain, because at least we still have a pound, we're slightly isolated from this, although, of course, the City of London is quite very much involved at the heart of it all. Is there any way out?
For Britain, yes, absolutely. I think Britain has a great opportunity, assuming it does leave the EU. But if you were to listen to Owen Smith, you might doubt that that will ever happen if he becomes the leader of the Labour Party. One of the great opportunities we have as a country is that once out of the EU, we can walk away from the Maastricht Treaty. The Maastricht Treaty forbids our country from borrowing from its own from its own state-owned central bank. If we can do that again, then we can start investing heavily in our industry, manufacturing, science, construction, our infrastructure. But whilst we remain in the Maastricht Treaty, we can't. We're bound to buy our money from private banks. This is one of the fundamental problems that affects all countries that do not have a state banking system. Now, as it happens, nearly one third of the entire world lives in countries that have state banking, and they don't suffer from the malaise that we suffer from. And the two biggest examples would be China and India. In China, it is almost completely owned or controlled by the state, banking that is. And in India, it is mostly owned or controlled by the state, approximately 90%. In those countries, because they're state-owned banking, they did not have the financial collapses that we had in the West, because it was a private banking financial crisis. It's very important to put the word private in front of it. In state bank controlled countries, they did not have these crashes. I was there in China in 2008. Yeah, there was a little bit of concern at the end of it. The government announced this investment program of about $580 billion, but they'd already slated that money for development anyway. It was just a publicity stunt. And by April 2009, everybody was back doing business again. I think they dipped from about 10% GDP growth down to about 6% in 2008-09 period, but then it bounced back again after that.
So look, this translates in Europe as the kind of difference between the Bundesbank and Deutsche Bank, or in Britain, the difference between the Bank of England and something like HSBC. So how does what you're saying translate over here? We just need to maybe even just allow these private banks to go bust since they're so massively indebted? What are you suggesting?
Absolutely agree with that. No private entity should be bailed out as they were in 2008. We need to set up a state banking system and allow the private banks to go bust.
Before we say goodbye, Gordon, since you're in China, give us you've been there, you say, for 11 years now. Just give us your impression of life in China, how it's different from here in Britain.
I like the life in China. The food is really, really excellent. The people are extremely friendly. The weather where I am is actually pretty nice most of the time. So that's kind of the things I kind of like about China. But I also love the UK. I'm actually in the Lake District. It's sunny, it's beautiful.
There's me thinking you're speaking to us from China.
No, I'm in Grasmere. I'm in Wordsworth country.
Okay, yeah, I can be completely fooled there. Just maybe talk about China for a minute, the possibilities of it as a tourist destination. What will people expect if they set off for a couple of weeks over in Beijing or maybe even in the outback?
Yeah, if you haven't been to China on holiday, you've just got to. It's the one place you got to go, and especially now before it becomes too developed. There are places like Shanghai and Beijing and, you know, Shenzhen and Hong Kong. Yeah, you can do all these things, and they're absolutely great cities. But when you get out to places like Xi'an, you know, where they have the Terracotta Warriors, or you go to Guilin, where they have like 1,000 sugarloaf hills, these places are stunning, absolutely stunning. And the culture's so different, the food's so different. I strongly recommend anyone to go there for at least, 10 days and just enjoy China as it is today.
Before it becomes McDonaldized, I suppose.
Well, the cities are very, very McDonaldized. I couldn't tell you how many McDonald's we've got in Zhongshan City alone. I mean, it must be at least 8 to 10 McDonald's there, I think.
No doubt they'll soon be springing up all across the Chinese countryside. So get there quick, folks.
Well, I'll tell you what I thought was really, really funny the other day. You know, KFC is very big in China, and we went to my wife's hometown. And right there in the central square, someone had set up a KFC copy called MFC, which for me stands for Middlesbrough Football Club. So I took a photograph of it and I shared it with all my Middlesbrough mates, and they were just howling with laughter at that.
Okay, Gordon, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, as part of the economic crisis, mainly actually after the 2008 bailouts, a lot of bankers has been dying. The one person that's really pulled all the information together online about this is blogger Michael Tyler.
My name's Michael Tyler and I'm currently in Staffordshire. It's something that wasn't receiving any coverage and it was really quite shocking, I thought. So I just thought, well, wow. So I got this list. I think I got it off. I certainly accredited it, but it was a collective commons kind of thing. And then I sort of vetted it a little bit, got rid of all the, there was a kind of a little bit, it was a little bit heavy on conspiracy. So I researched it all again and looked at all the sources again and looked at all the stories that I could possibly find and sort of, I just vetted it and then I put it on my blog.
So why is it that somebody like you in their spare time, just because they're bored with watching TV, which to be fair, tens of millions of people just here in Britain are probably doing that right tonight. But why is it that you think that none of the mainstream press has actually bothered to do this actually very important job, which is to show the bigger picture of a drip, drip, trickle story?
Because they've got the fear of God. I mean, these bankers were saying that they were the most powerful people in the galaxy. And that's the, you know, they said it for years. Oh, we're the most, you know, no one could, we're just above, we are an entity, you know, nothing. And suddenly these big egos have turned out to be just shysters. And if anybody wants to get involved with egos like that, you can, like the list shows, you'll probably end up not living very long, basically. So I think there's a lot of big egos involved within the banking industry, as we well know from the Lehman's guy, who's, you know, some huge egos going on there, and people don't mess with them, you know, it doesn't happen.
Well, so, they obviously are messing with some of them, because surely not all of these 100 or so bankers are suicides.
Well, I think that that's what's happening, is that they're using not orthodox channels. I'm just a humble journalist, well, I suppose a journalist of sorts, that has found something of interest. Reporting on it is a lot more difficult than actually bumping someone off. I think you'd kind of, in terms of the kind of flack that you're going to get, it'd be much easier just to, you know, to cut them off. But if you write a story about it, then, you know, your newspaper, you're kind of probing into things, which everybody knows was that whole LIBOR scandal, which the guy from Deutsche Bank, they paid $2.5 billion to silence the London authorities, to silence what used to be the FSA and is now a toothless quango. They paid $2.5 billion to silence him, and that guy, he got bumped off as well. So, I mean, talking about, like, this is like murder at the highest level kind of thing. So,
well, how come these guys, these, some of them, seem to have kind of impunity? Why are they above the law?
Well, they're the masters of the universe, I guess.
Well, doesn't say a lot for the abilities of things like the Serious Fraud Office or Financial Regulation Authority, or the FSA as it now is. And I think, you know, certainly your list does paint this picture of a kind of twilight world where, although the rewards can be enormous, there are also dangers. I mean, what are your thoughts about what proportion of these bankers were genuine suicides? Obviously, some, you know, are likely to be people who have just had enough in an extremely high stress job, and to what extent there's actually a kind of, you know, banker death squads out there.
Statistically, I would probably say I've got 72 bankers on my list, and this is spanning from perhaps 2006. So over perhaps 10 years, we've got 72 cases of what's called premature death. Looking quite analytically at those figures, I'd say, percentage-wise, I'd say perhaps 70% would be assisted death, to put it as best you can. I'd say they were assisted death. 25% is possibly just misadventure, but I'd say 75%.
You know, people may say murder, but I mean, I would even use the word assassination, because to a large extent, banks these days play an extremely important political role. And so, you know, if you've got a political murder, it should rightfully be called an assassination. Anyway, how long has it taken you to put this pretty definitive list with all its references together, Michael?
Well, I started doing it in, I suppose it was 2014, I think it was, when I initially, I suppose, did the research, the background research on it. And I think 2013 was the big year. It really was. There was just deaths all the time. I mean, there was like 3 deaths in a week, 1 week. I've looked at it in the light of different external factors, and it has, I suppose, 2013 has been the big year, and then it's kind of, I guess, that whatever, I think the earliest one was 2006, but it's kind of gone up. It went up, not when the financial crisis hit, but a number of years later, in 2013, there was a huge spike.
So what's the reason for this 2013 banker death bubble, do you think?
A lot of these people had something called dead peasants insurance. Dead peasants insurance is something where your employer employs you and indemnifies themselves against your against their kind of loss of IP.
Oh, so, hang on, that sounds pretty dicey. So your employer is taking you on, but they're also taking out a big insurance policy. If you happen to fall off a cliff, then they get extra money.
That's exactly what happens.
I don't think I'd sign a contract like that with a bank if I was a banker. Anyway, look, I know you've had a look at just a few example cases. Can you run through those for us to give us an idea of who these people are, how they died?
I think the main one, I think, was the guy that shot himself with a nail gun. This was an American. He was a CEO. His name was Richard Talley, founder of American Title Services in Denver. His wife insured, had an insurance policy on him, and I think he had this dead peasants insurance, or there's some sort of insurance policy running on him, according to the Denver Post, which coincidentally has now removed the page which has been referenced in the Daily Mail. That's now 404. So he had apparently taken this nail gun and at will just fired, as you would do if you wanted to commit suicide, just fire nails into yourself just randomly. Another one was a female banker. She'd slit her own throat, and there was no sign of the weapon. I don't know what happened there with regards to the facts, but she, it says here, Sean Miller, Citigroup manager director, found dead in the bathtub with throat slashed. Murder weapon is missing. So, yeah.
She'd have to throw it through a window a very long, long, long way away, so no one would ever find it. I mean, surely that it's obvious that there's someone else has killed her. It just amazes me that the authorities can continually find that these people have somehow committed suicide. I mean, it doesn't seem like that. Most of these people, almost all of them on the list, are American, European bankers working for those banks. Some certainly part of the sort of Western networks, including places like Japan, Australia, etc. But what about China's a very big financial power nowadays. Is there any Chinese on the list?
Yeah, we've got this guy called Li Jinhua. He was working for the Financial Institution Supervision Department of the People's Republic of China. He had a heart attack. That's perhaps not as high profile as the guy who was actually the risk analyst who I was talking about. But the Chinese are basically They haven't had their financial crisis yet. I mean, what they've done is with the guy who was working for the government, he obviously wasn't involved personally, but they do have. I mean, they've got a shadow banking industry to match no other. So when I did the blog, and having come back from China, I kind of tried to juxtapose the two situations. I mean, I know that they look to the West, and they try and everything that America does, the Chinese kind of, in a way, they'll try and sort of take the good, and they'll try and replicate it in many ways. They try and do that, and I think with this banking thing that they've got. For example, when I was going to work one day, I said, oh, how come everyone's got these lovely, lovely new cars? Everyone drives around in cars. Everyone's, you know, with beautiful cars around here. And our driver, who was just, you know, bod, anyone, he just said, no, these are all bank cars. So it was like, you know, it just dawned on me that China is, I suppose, the, as I put it on my blog, the next dollop of heading towards the fan. I don't know whether they have, you know, my list will expand, but that's my view on it.
What about solutions to all this and a proper sort of analysis? Because it does seem as if potentially your list is a whole bunch of good guys. I mean, we talk about more and more, we talk about the banking sector after 2008, the great rip-off bailout scandal, really, which was the kind of crime of the century, stealing vast amounts of billions from the public purse to look after these people who are basically incompetent, idiotic, useless bankers who are bust, and then they use that money to then lobby for more power. So there's certainly a pretty clear bankster elite out there. But is it fair to say that possibly these people have been gotten out of the way because they're more honest?
Probably. I think a lot of them would appear to be weak links. I'd say that even if your face fits, there's a climate of fear. And where there's a climate of fear, it's like fascism. It's like a manipulation of the authority, that once you create that climate, that's a good thing. You know, you're... the shots are a lot easier to call. You know, if you don't jump, look what happened to, you know, the MD, or look what happened to our director, or look what happened to some of the biggest names in the banking industry. I mean, we've got like Jimmy Lee, the CEO of JP Morgan, and...
People talk about this, you know, in intelligence circles. I mean, we're talking about GCHQ, MI6, MI5, pointing the finger at David Kelly, the weapons expert who died at the time of the Iraq war in mysterious circumstances, found dead in the woods, had his body moved, hadn't actually committed suicide according to most doctor analysis, and yet he was found dead. There was also the GCHQ cryptographer Gareth Williams, who was found basically chopped up in a bag, although I don't know if he's actually chopped up, but he was dead in a hold-all in this London flat, and the Metropolitan Police come along and say, oh, well, it was clearly no one else involved. Now, these that send out very strong signals to anybody in an organisation that it is possible to murder you, so you better keep your mouth shut. And I imagine that's a similar sort of message being sent out to senior bank employees, executives, etc. I also wonder what you make of the way people like Tom Hayes appear to have been scapegoated, somebody who was a very, really low-level trader doing what he was told to do by his bosses, and yet his bosses are still walking free.
It's just a standard, I suppose, creating a power control structure. I suppose many of the bankers themselves are beholden to the larger shareholders, and this whole thing was built on moving shares around in derivatives, just bundling them up. So, I mean, I've no doubt that the bigger players and the people that don't even have jobs, the people like, I suppose, who are just the shadowy movers of and owners of the stock exchange, basically, and all those beneath them are just numbers.
So what's your advice, if there are any bankers listening? How do you stay alive?
I'd get rid of your dead peasants insurance, reinsure yourself, make sure you don't get knocked off by your own company, obviously. I suppose most bankers are trying to get out of banking, aren't they, really? A lot of them became disillusioned.
Now, look, I mean, I've got news for you, because that money, that paycheck, those £1 million annual salaries can be quite addictive.
Yeah, I know. I guess I'm kind of, I suppose that was the headlines of 2008, but they all got quantitatively eased, didn't it? And they're still pumping more than ever into, you know, the pockets of bankers. So maybe they're not. Maybe they're just hanging around and looking scared. Who knows?
Any last bits of advice for bankers? How to stay alive?
If I was a banker, what would I do? I'd just be paranoid. I think you know, in terms of life expectancy, paranoia, it's your best friend, you know.
See your annual paycheck or your monthly paycheck as danger money, and be ready to run at any moment. Anyway, Michael Tyler, number one, thanks very much for all the work you've done on this very important subject. Shame on the mainstream press for hardly touching it. Absolutely pathetic job, CNN, BBC, ITV, all the rest of you. And Michael, thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Eschatology is the study, mostly the religious study through the Bible and the Quran, of the end of the world. Very few people talk or even think about this, but one group that does is Global Vision 2000 in London. Their organiser is Moeen Yassin.
This is Moeen Yassin, director of Global Vision 2000, the independent Islamic think tank.
And you were, I believe, a conference on Yemen at the weekend. Do you know who organised it? And maybe you could just give us a little report on what happened.
Yeah, I'd be delighted. I mean, I was in Scotland at the time I came down because I thought it was very important. I didn't really know who organised it until I went in good faith. Apparently, there is a website, an organisation called ShibaRights.org. ShibaRights.org, those who want to pursue it. And apparently it's a coalition of Yemeni and other NGO organisations.
Okay, well, so can you take us through what happened there? Because, I mean, I think anyone that is aware of what's going on in Yemen is really, I suppose, amazed at the lack of coverage, particularly since a lot of money is being made for British arms companies and a lot of the weapons that are being used to kill innocent people, women, children, bomb hospitals, bomb schools, day after day for the last 18 months or so with a few short breaks. The money is being made from these munitions here in Britain, and the arms licences are being signed off by our Foreign Secretary.
That is correct. So which aspect did you want me to focus on?
Well, I don't mind. I think if you could just take us through the day. What were the highlights for you of the interesting aspects of this conference?
Well, surprisingly, it was well organised. It was a 2-day event in a 5-star hotel, Pullman, next to the King's Cross St Pancras. And a lot of the attendees were not just UK. They had come from different countries, from Europe and Middle East and Asia. It's one of the first major international conferences supporting the Yemeni people vis-a-vis the Saudi, obviously, aggression. They brought together leaders in especially the human rights area. I didn't see too many politicians, journalists, yeah, but not mainstream media. No English MP, some from Ireland, Sinn Féin, Scotland, and from England except the trade union, Stop the War and Unite. So that was quite glaring, obviously, Saudi lobbying behind the scenes. And they gave a comprehensive overview of the humanitarian and political situation in the Yemen. Obviously, the background to all of this, the so-called Arab Spring and its Yemeni dimension, which was kicked off in February the 11th, 2011, at the university in Sana'a till now. So basically, the bottom line is the country, the impression I got, I wasn't fully aware, the country has been destroyed, its infrastructure, by mainly UK and American high-tech weapons.
Now, this conference is taking place in the middle of London. Was there much acknowledgement that this, in a way, is not really the Saudis' war? It seems to be, you know, it wouldn't be able to happen without the backing of and the support from a kind of shadowy US-UK elite behind the scenes.
I was the first person to stand up during Q&A session after Lindsay German. I told her, stop the war has stopped no war. And indeed, we're heading towards World War III. And that's the point I made, which you've just made. I mean, we've got an axis of evil. It's okay blaming the Saudis, which Galloway did. Galloway only attacked the Saudis. He didn't even mention, surprisingly, the UK or US. That was my point. I said we need to identify the axis of evil in Washington, London, Vatican, and Tel Aviv.
Hang on, why do you say the Vatican there? Why does they get included in your list?
We have done research which shows that the Vatican is deeply enmeshed in this. Two examples. Rothschild, as you know, is he an independent agent?
Well, hang on, just a minute. You say Rothschild, but sorry to keep quizzing you, but there are lots of Rothschilds out there. Which one are you talking about?
I'm talking about the dynasty. I'm just making a generic point. Is Rothschild, did he appear out of the blue at the head of the apex of the banking system, or is he an agent of another entity? We've got research which documents he is an agent of the Vatican. He didn't appear out of the blue. And also, when Bush declared the 9/11, you know, so-called global war on terror, which is global war off terror, he used the word crusade, and then it was off air. Now, crusade has got a history, the whole concept of a crusade. So anyway, my point is that the Saudis were bought into power by Britain after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and America, and they are a proxy for the global elite.
Is there any solution at the conference about what to do about the situation in Yemen, using our British Typhoon jets and Tornado jets to kill innocent people?
Yes. I mean, for instance, CAT was the campaign against arms trade. They made a good contribution on the UK dimension in British aerospace, for instance. And some MPs, the Scottish Muslim MP, Tasmina, talked about, you know, campaigning on the arms licensing, you know, to Saudi Arabia, etc., etc. But basically, yes, there was a conference declaration to alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Basically, the bottom line is, you know, to establish a ceasefire and end the aerial bombings by the so-called coalition, led by Saudi Arabia, and the blockade, which includes US and UK and American ships. So ceasefire, ending the bombing, the blockade, and obviously a peaceful resolution to the whole conflict.
What is the Yemeni place in Middle East culture?
That was exposed by various Islamic channels' videos, including the London-based Ahle Bayt channel, which I've been on. They've done a special documentary, and others, actually. I mean, basically, I mean, you know, Arabia Felix, the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen historically has been central to the Bedouin or the Arab identity, from the Queen of Sheba. And even now in the Arabian Peninsula, the Yemeni population numbers over 20 million, you know, very significant. So history, even now, even in the building of Saudi Arabia, there are many Yemenis, by the way, in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis have to be careful about what they've unleashed. There are very strong connections tribally and otherwise, business-wise, etc., between Yemen and entirety of Saudi Arabia.
Well, given that you've got these big colonial powers still with their fingers in the pie, Britain and America, in Yemen and in Saudi Arabia, what do you think is realistically is the future for that part of the world?
Well, that's why Global Vision's having an event. We're just about to pencil in the date in London on eschatology in the 21st century, interfaith comparative perspectives. In Islamic, I don't think we can look at this in isolation. Of course, you can say it's about the people's voice for democracy against dictators backed by the Saudi Empire, backed by the Anglo-American Zionist empire, and the bankers on top of that. However, in Islamic eschatology, Syria, Sham is referred to, Greater Syria, and Yemen, these are clear pointers of special events which will take place and are taking place relevant to the coming of the Mahdi, the Imam Mahdi, because the key dimension that's missing, especially in the Middle East, if not the Islamic world, is leadership. That is the significance of the Imam Mahdi and his leadership, including military, by the way.
Now, this is a key thing, isn't it? Because many people who've joined Islamic State believe that they are going to be the people who produce this kind of saviour for the Islamic world. And I wonder if there's any kind of crossover between, I mean, traditionally in Christian thinking, it's the Book of Revelation and other areas. And in Jewish thinking, the Book of Daniel, for example, has got its view of what will happen at the end of the world. But how does this, if at all, fit in with what's in the Quran?
I think we shouldn't underestimate the military, what we refer to as the apex of the cartel, of the pyramid. But the military, industrial, security, intelligence complex are aware of Islamic history. Very aware. Last thing they want is the revival of the caliphate of any shape, form. So I think they have intervened in this region, in the Middle East, which they know, which is also central to their global empire, you know, the petrodollar in particular. They are aware of Muslim eschatology. Those who pretend that they aren't aware haven't got a clue about the Western military, industrial, security, intelligence complex. And I think they are preparing, they have been preparing to subvert it. Indeed, in the Hadith literature, the prophetic sayings, which are codified, it mentions there will be two black flags in this time. It's that detailed. The people don't know that Muslims don't just have the Quran, but the recorded sayings of Muhammad. There's a whole science other than analogy and reason. And in the eschatological literature, it mentions there will be two factions, black flags. Now, is it not interesting that in Afghanistan, for instance, you've got the Taliban? They got the black flag, yeah? And now you've got ISIS or Daesh, which is a NATO Zionist creation, they've got a black flag. And do you know something? They're fighting each other in places like Afghanistan, which is recorded. Now, this is reported in the Hadith literature. It might surprise you.
Okay, Moeen, fascinating insight into the conflict in Yemen and how it fits into the bigger picture. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, Moeen, cheers. And your website, just remind us on the recording again, is Global Vision.
GlobalVision2000.com, and our eschatological event is happening, I think, the first week. The date's about to be set, probably for December the 3rd.
Okay, great. London. Let me know when it is. It'd be interesting to report on that. Okay?
Yeah. Okay, thank
All
you.
All the best.
Andrew Conrad.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Germans are worried that the Pentagon and the Americans are trying to get them to have a war with Russia. The Americans themselves probably wouldn't be involved. They'll be miles away. But there are increasing numbers of Germans that want to have peace with Russia, not war. And Max Backman from Dresden has been over to Moscow with nearly 250 of his colleagues. That was around about 2 weeks, and they went from Berlin to Moscow. So here's Max Backman now.
I'm Max Backman from Dresden, Germany. And me, myself, and 235 other people, we went from Berlin to Moscow from August 7th to August 21st, and I was there following the whole tour with two cameras to shoot a little documentary, and yes, I did some reports and daily blog.
Now, 235 is quite a lot of people. Do you have a lot of cars, and how many miles? What was your route?
Well, the route started in Berlin, obviously. Then we went to cities like Kaliningrad, Pskov, and St. Petersburg, and then reached our goal in Moscow. But we did some other little or smaller towns in between, or even visited like little villages which are 100 kilometers from every other town around, which was very fascinating.
Okay, but how many vehicles? 235, that's a lot of people. Must have been quite a convoy.
Yeah, it's were 7 vehicles. I mean, some of them went in a tour bus where around 40 people, I think, had place. And yeah, that's basically. And we had some motorcycles too, and some people who even slept in their cars with.
So, what sort of reception did you get along the way?
Well, it was a very positive reception, even though we thought that, especially in the Baltic area, we might get some criticism by the people, because obviously NATO just placed their troops there and they are influenced by Western media propaganda and stuff like that. So we had some fears that this would happen, but we were welcomed very nicely and very kindly everywhere. And yeah, we had good conditions to travel.
Tell us about some of the towns and the cities you visited, including some of the villages. What were they like? Because many people in Britain have never been to Eastern Europe, and certainly not to Russia.
Yeah, sure. Well, I can't say much about the cities in Eastern Europe in general, because we kind of only stayed a night there. But in Russia, towns were very interesting. People are very patriotic there, which I found very interesting. They have a high sense of memorizing their or showing memorial and going to memorials of the Second World War. That was very fascinating. So every couple of kilometers, there are big memorial stones just big memorials.
So how did they, you're Germans, how did they receive you? Because, you know, that was one of the main, if not the main, battlefronts in the Second World War, was between your country and theirs.
Yeah, sure. That's also what we wanted to find out. And the tour in general was so that this would not happen again. And the Russians, even some veterans that we met at those memorials, welcomed us very, very, very good. And they didn't show any hatred or anything else because of our past.
Now, and, I mean, what was the point of your tour then? 235 people all the way from Berlin to Moscow and back. What's the point?
Yeah, well, the initiators picked the tour dates pretty short before, like 3 or 4 months before we left in Berlin. That was because of the recent NATO activity on the Russian border, and they fear, the initiators and also the participants fear that a war might break out, and they wanted to intervene.
Now, NATO are saying that Russia is a threat. That's why they have to move troops to the border. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I don't really think that's the case, because Russian people seemed very peaceful to me, at least the people who live there today and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't really think that's the case. So the people in Russia, at least those who we met, they don't want war, and they don't celebrate war.
Now, what about the media coverage? Because I know you, as part of your tour, which was really a kind of peace tour, really, between cementing ordinary people in Germany with Russia, the media in Germany and in Russia, did they cover your tour? Did they have a look at your exploits? And did you get much traction from the press?
Well, in Berlin, we were covered by German mainstream media, or at least they were there, but we never saw any reports on it on our on the television.
Now, hang on. You mean you had a reporter reporting on you, but they didn't actually put it on the TV?
Yes, that's correct.
So who was that? Which broadcaster?
That was the second German TV channel. It's Zweites Deutsches Fernsehen.
Right. So I mean, are you sure that they didn't put any reports out? Are you just guessing?
No, I'm pretty sure. I mean, there are some others, like the Bavarian. I think the Bavarian television did some report, and now there are local news channels and obviously German alternative media, which is not small. They covered it. Yeah. So.
And what about the Russians?
The Russians, like the mainstream media in Russia, multiple channels of those who were even financed by the state of Russia, welcomed us in Berlin and followed us all the way to Moscow and even back to Berlin.
So the CDF in Germany, it does sound strange when you have a reporter come down to do a report and then they don't actually transmit anything. That must make you wonder about the fairness, really, of the media on both sides of the divide. So you would hope that both of the media in Germany and in Russia would want to cover this, as it's a move by ordinary people to make sure that there is no war. So what do you put this down to?
Well, I think it kind of didn't really fit in their narrative of kind of propagating that Russian people are, or the Russian state at least, is this evil counteract to the good Western world. And so that's, I think, why they did not cover it.
Now, when you got to Moscow, did you have a party, a nice reception?
Yeah, well, funny thing was the day that we arrived in Moscow, they had like the biggest rain and kind of like since river has been put down or written down. So we had the biggest rainfall there and we were 2 hours late because of that. And so there was not any big reception, but in general, people, when they saw our cars, which were marked with flags and stuff like that, they really always waved at us, and they treated us very kindly
in the rain.
In the rain, but we stayed 3 days in Moscow, and we had better weather later.
And is it the first time you visited Moscow?
Yes, for me it was.
And what
the first
did you
time.
Make of it?
Well, it's a very beautiful city, very clean city too, and the people, as I said, they seem to be very nice. There has only been one incident between a driver or a participant of the tour and Russian, but even he said, there are bad people everywhere. So, but the majority seemed very friendly and,
What do you make of the young people in Moscow? Because, since 1990 and the end of the Soviet Union, I think it's fair to say that there's a kind of new generation growing up.
Yes. So in Moscow, what I thought was surprising is that there's lots of McDonald's, lot of like Western stores and stuff like that, so I think they kind of grow up similar to the West. But what I also noticed is that a lot of people who put on the shows at the memorial events to celebrate with us, there were lots of younger people too. And so I think even though there is a Western influence in Russia on the youth, I think they're still being taught to kind of stay true to their traditions and their heritage.
And do they speak good English and German, did you find?
Oh, no, not at all. I met roughly, I don't want to say a number, but there were very few people where I could communicate in English with. Mostly in restaurants, but not even there sometimes. So it was very hard, since I don't speak a word in Russian and also can't read the letters.
That's right. The Cyrillic text is a bit complicated, kind of like Greek, isn't it? Anyway, look, what about your YouTube film? Because I know you've got a film up about this. So where can people find that?
Well, I have a short film with one of the initiators up on journalist.org. It's with GER in the beginning. That's a short interview with one of the initiators and backed with some footage from the tour, and then I'm editing right now on a documentary on the whole tour, which will be out in hopefully 3 or 4 months, and I hopefully will get to translate that in English as well. So
okay, Max Backman, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Gordon Stiles, Michael Tyler at michaeltyler.co.uk, Moeen Yassin from Global Division 2000, and Max Backman, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk, also Volunteering Bristol. on 0117 989 7733. Online at volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or you can even use the national volunteering site do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.